All politics are local.
Same way as I did, missing out the cracks in the pavement and tarting my heel and strutting my feet. Is there anything I can do for you, dear? Is there anyone I could call? No and thank you, please, madame. I was just wondering. From my hometown, maybe memories are fresh. From my hometown, ooh, the people I've made are the ones. Wonders of my world are the wonders of my world, are the wonders of this world.
This is Politics is Local, a special election time program of KHOI Community Radio, bringing an exploration of issues, candidates, and constituents in our community.
I love to see everybody in short skirts, shorts, and shades.
This program will be airing Thursday morning at 7 a.m. and will be rebroadcast on Saturdays at 9 a.m. I'm your host for today, Gail Seiler. The phrase, all politics is local, is a popular political saying, most often associated with the former House Speaker Thomas P. or Tip O'Neill, who used the saying in his first political campaign in 1935. Politics is local, so let's get started. The topic for the second half of the show, which will come up later, is education. We'll be starting with education issues that have arisen on the campaign trail at the national level, and then switching to more local issues around education here in Iowa. But before we get to that, and keeping with the idea that politics is local, KHOI has been reaching out to the candidates for the Senate race in Iowa, Senator Chuck Grassley and his opponent Patty Judge, and also to candidates for the 4th Congressional District of Iowa, Representative Steve King and his opponent Kim Weaver. We hope to get interviews with all four of these candidates talking about a wide range of issues. On Tuesday, KHOI was visited by Kim Weaver of Sheldon, Iowa, a candidate for the 4th Congressional District on the Democratic ticket. Ms. Weaver was on her way to that evening's water forum held by local Democrats at Collegiate United Methodist Church. Local talk reporter Greta Anderson sat down with Kim Weaver for a conversation, and let's hear that now.
Kim Weaver is the Democratic candidate for a 4th District congressional seat, opposing Steve King. 39 counties to cover. Is this the largest district in
Iowa?
It is.
There's 99 counties in the state.
What is your strategy to defeat Steve King? Others have not succeeded. What is your strategy?
We're mixing it up a little bit. We really need to talk about his outrageous comments because it reflects on his personality and his character. It doesn't represent Iowa well. One of the things that we're focusing on is that Steve King is the least effective member of Congress. InsideGov.com, nonpartisan organization that ranked all members of Congress and found him the least effective.
And what criteria were they using?
They looked at how many bills were introduced, how many bills got out of subcommittee. He had absolutely nothing get out of subcommittee in 14 years, and he's cashed almost $2.5 million in paychecks. It's actually good that he wasn't very successful, because the votes that he took would have actually hurt Iowans. As an example, his votes were to privatize Social Security and voucherize Medicare. That would have hurt a huge amount of people in his district. And Medicaid, it's amazing to me. He wants to weaken Medicare, which means that people are going to run through their resources more quickly. I want to expand Medicare to cover nursing homes and assisted livings, because as a long-term care ombudsman, I see people having to sell their century farms, to be able to pay for their nursing home care. And the Administration on Aging estimates that the cost of a nursing home by 2037 will be over $20,000 a month. I don't know too many people who can afford that. And people ask me, so how are you going to pay for this expansion of Medicare? I'll tell you what, we're already paying for it. The nursing homes that I go into, close to 50% of the people there are there on Medicaid, which is 100% taxpayer dollars. And I think that if we can expand Medicare, one, we're going to help people protect their farms. We're going to help people protect their retirements. And so putting into Medicare and expanding that means we're not going to have to be using the money for Medicaid.
You say they were already paying for Medicaid, mm-hmm. but you want to expand it.
I want to expand Medicare.
Okay.
So there's Medicare and Medicaid. Yeah, that's okay. Medicare is something that we all pay into. And once we reach a certain age, then we're entitled to use it for our health insurance. But it doesn't pay if you fall and break a hip. It'll help pay for skilled care if you go in for rehab. But let's say you go in for rehab and you just can't move back home. Then you have to pay for it. Right now it's $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month, depending on where you live. Most people can't afford that for very long. And so what happens is you spend everything you have, you sell your home, and then you get down to only $2,000 in resources, and then you go on Medicaid. And Medicaid is funded 100% by taxpayer dollars, by taxes, not, you know, the little bit you pay in on your weekly or your paycheck. So it's a different funding stream, and it's a different funding burden.
Steve King has voted to...
to weaken, to cut actually Medicaid dollars, and to weaken Medicare by voucherizing it. Here's how much money you get. If you have a catastrophic illness or a major surgery, you could very conceivably run through what you have, and then you start losing everything you own again.
How do we keep medical costs and end-of-life costs in check? We have the highest healthcare costs in the world here in the United States.
I think that we haven't really focused on a lot of the preventative things that we can do for people. And to me, that makes sense. And also, we don't have a lot of creative community-based services for people. Take example, a senior who's on Medicaid and they're getting supports in the community. They get $1,117 a month on the elderly waiver to pay for their basic services. If they need to go over that, they end up going to a nursing home. And then again, it's $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a month to pay for that. Now, if we had people who were in the community who could help people stay there, then that would help a lot. As a matter of fact, I have been the chair of the Health and Human Services Subcommittee for the Platform Committee for the Democratic Party, not this cycle because I'm a little busy, but the last two cycles. And supports and tax breaks for caregivers is among one of the things that we pushed, because it used to be that, you know, families took care of families. It's difficult now with, you know, how mobile people are, and everybody has jobs, and you get people who are kind of that sandwich generation. They're taking care of their parents and they're taking care of their kids. So if they could have some breaks so that, you know, they can care for their parents and not be strapped financially, and it saves us as well, that'd be a fabulous solution.
You mentioned college loans. So what is your plan for that?
I have three kids. My oldest son went to MIT in aerospace engineering. My daughter's a third-year medical student, and my youngest son is in geology at Iowa State. I'm a single mom, and I had somebody say that evidently that my 2 cents worth on the Des Moines Register, somebody said, well, she must not be hurting financially because her kids went to these schools. I said, let's say it's called Pell Grants, Scholarships, and Student Loans. There's absolutely no way I'd be able to pay for that. So my kids will have a huge debt burden, just like most kids. So what I want to do is have an expansion of the AmeriCorps VISTA volunteer program. I'm calling it iGive, Generating Investment Through Volunteer Engagement. And it will allow new grads with debt to work in the community 4 hours a week, volunteer, have their loan payments and their interest deferred, and then at the end of the year when they turn in their taxes, they turn in a form with how many hours they gave and have a portion of their loans forgiven. So that way these young kids can volunteer to help a senior in their home and help keep them in their home. I worked with one lady who fell down her basement stairs just because she didn't have anybody help her with her laundry, broke her hip, and that's how she ended up in the nursing home. So we went from a minimal, you know, $1,200 a month to $7,000, $8,000 a month, and she was on Medicaid. So that was all 100% taxes. So if we can get kids who can volunteer to help with these things, then that's going to save us a lot of money in the long run. And it's not just with seniors. They could volunteer to have tutoring sessions for kids at schools on Saturdays. They could, you know, clean up the parks. They could work at an animal shelter. They could work at a homeless shelter. There's so many things that the people could volunteer based on their passion, but it's also something that could help build their resume. So if they're going to, say, go work on, say, come to this radio station and help work on your computer system or your website, is going to give them more experience to put on their resume.
If you get elected and
win,
you will be a freshman.
Yes.
How would you go about promoting such a plan, which is kind of your brainchild?
Well, actually, I've talked to a few current members of Congress. I'm not going to name any names yet because I'm working on them signing off on the dotted line that they support it. So I'm trying to get as many candidates as well as members of Congress to support it so that, you know, God forbid I don't win. I'm not even going to think about that. But if I don't, then there's people to carry it forward as well, because I deeply believe that the student loan debt burden is our next financial crisis. And this is something that we need to address. It's very important. So when I get in there, I'm already starting to build some coalitions, and I talk to a lot of people in my district, not just Democrats, and the Republicans that I talk to like the plan, the no party people, the Green Party members, they like the plan. And I think it resonates with people because we're not just giving them something for free. They're contributing back to the community. So I believe it's a plan that a lot of people can get behind, both on both sides of the aisle.
How do you get these ideas out there? How do you get your name recognized, and how do you get people to vote for you?
Well, we have a pretty extensive network of people who are volunteering, who are making phone calls. We are, as a campaign, focusing mostly on no party members and certain Republicans, because the Democratic Party is taking care of the Democrats. And in this district, we can't win with just Democrats. I mean, that's just a given. Every single day, I have Republicans telling me that they're voting for me. And so it's a different kind of election cycle. It's something that I don't think we've ever seen. And so our approach is different than the last two election cycles, where they focus primarily on Democrats. I have a lot of Trump supporters telling me they're voting for me. I know. People will come up and say, I'm voting for you. And then say, oh, but I'm voting for Trump. And I just say, thank you for your vote.
What is the story on the debates? When are you going to get to match your ideas up to Steve King's?
Well, the Sioux City Journal put out a poll just recently, and I believe overwhelmingly most people said at least two debates. King's camp has not responded at all, and we're working with a couple of different entities to sponsor debates. I was president of the speech team at Iowa State, so I'll be ready. Just not sure if he'll show up.
Okay. I'm talking with Kim Weaver. She is the Democratic candidate for 4th District in the U.S. House of Representatives, facing off against incumbent Steve King. You're on the record as promoting immigration reform.
Comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. And when I started doing my research on this, I was amazed the American Farm Bureau actually supports comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. It's actually one of their priority issues, their legislative issues. And they had a wonderful report on their website that they commissioned, and they found that if we followed the immigration policy that both Trump and King are promoting, it could increase farm labor by 149%. It would drive farmers out of business. It would cause us to have to import food because we wouldn't be able to harvest it. So it was kind of an eye-opener to me. But on a more personal level, My daughter went to school with a gal who married a man. Actually, I don't believe they actually got married. Was with a gentleman who was from Mexico. He came up here when he was 14, all by himself. Worked really, really hard. He worked in the hog barns and the chicken barns and everything else. And he got deported. And they had a newborn, and I believe the other one was 2. And he was murdered when he went back to Mexico. And that wouldn't have happened if we had comprehensive immigration reform. So it's not just common sense, it's also compassion.
There was an article a few weeks ago about your promotion of industrial hemp.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I went to an Iowa Hemp Association meeting last year, I think it was sometime in August, and learned more
There's
about it.
There's an Iowa Hemp Association.
Yes, there is an Iowa Hemp Association. And I learned more about the product and what you can do with it. They called it Hemp Creek, where they would make like concrete with hemp, and it was strong and you know very durable. You can make fabric from it, you can make paper from it. And I really like the idea of making paper from it, because then we're not cutting down slow growth trees and worrying about deforestation. But one of the side benefits to it is that because of the way the root system is, it helps to decrease soil erosion, and it also helps to mitigate nitrates. And so I talked with Bill Stowe from the Des Moines Water Works about it, I don't know, a few weeks ago, and asked him if that would be a plausible solution to help with some of the nitrate runoff, and he said yes, that it would. I mean, obviously it wouldn't be the complete and total solution. It is legal federally, but it needs to be legalized on a statewide basis. And I think a lot of people are thinking, oh, it's you're going to smoke, get pot, and everything. No, you can't get high from it. So I just think it's something we need to look at. And actually, the pork producers, according to the Hemp Association on their little brochure, because the protein content in hemp is good for pigs.
Is hemp a perennial crop or an annual crop? Is it one you have to plant every year?
You have to plant it, but it's not fickle. It doesn't corn doesn't like to get its feet wet, so it's a little bit more fickle than hemp is. Just the way the root system does it, it helps to mitigate erosion, and I think that we need to look at all solutions. Everything that we can do to help farmers as well, and there's a market for it. And so I say, why not?
You're here in Ames on your way to the water forum. So
yes.
Most of our water issues here in Iowa are state-level decisions. How, as a potentially a federal legislator, how would you go about using what you know?
Certainly that there's a lot of rules and regulations that are implemented on a state level. However, federally, the U.S. Department of Agriculture can do a lot to help farmers to develop programs of conservation and to help with soil erosion programs and things like that. So I'm not an expert on it at this point by any stretch of the imagination, but I want to learn more and I want to know what can be done. I am very much focused on solutions. In my job, they say I investigate complaints, but I like to consider myself a solution facilitator. And you can't figure out a solution unless you know the problems and then the possible solutions. So that's why I'm going, and it's a very, very important issue for all of us. I'm not somebody that points a finger at the farmers and said, oh, you're bad, it's all your fault. We need to work together because we all need clean water.
How will you advocate for the disabled?
I was a targeted Medicaid case manager for people with chronic mental illnesses and kids with developmental disabilities, and now I work with seniors. So I have almost 20 years of experience in that area. One of the things that I have seen that is a stumbling block for a lot of people with disabilities is the inability to have a flexible work opportunity. So people will get Social Security, either SSDI or SSI, and they're not able to work very much because of the rules that are put in place. And I think we need to encourage people to be able to work as much as they can and to be able to have flexible schedules for some people. And the people that I worked with who had chronic mental illnesses, it was difficult because they would go and get a job, they'd be doing well, and then their Social Security would drop off and they'd be supporting themselves, and then they'd have a setback and they'd have to reapply and they'd lost their medical benefits. We need to have a system that encourages people to work but doesn't punish them for doing so as well. I have a friend who has a severe chronic mental illness, and she has struggled with it for a long time, has worked part-time on and off, and that was definitely used against her. It took almost 3 years before she had her hearing, and then she was denied. So now she has to reapply, and it's challenging enough to live with depression. It's even more so when you're having to prove that you have depression and that you need supports, because I know that she would never choose this. This would not be what she would choose. And I think that we need to look at efficiency and try to figure out a way of, you know, it's not just black or white. We need to have a spectrum of how we support people. And as an example with DHS, if you make just a dollar more, then, you know, here's the cutoff. You're either getting supports or you're getting nothing. And that just doesn't make sense to me.
What do you think of the pipeline?
I am adamantly opposed to the use of eminent domain to take private property for private profit. As an Iowan, I'm appalled that people's farmland, their farmland, and some of those I'm pretty darn sure were Century Farms, is being taken from them. Because our governor just decided, basically, well, the utilities board, but I don't believe it's a utility, that's a different issue, that they can do that. And there's some debate in the Democratic Party, because it does also provide union jobs. And I'm a union supporter, but when I talk to my union brothers and sisters and I say, would you want your private property taken for private profit? And they all say no. Plus, we need to decrease our dependence on oil anyway. I mean, we don't need oil. We need to decrease that instead of increase the supply.
Some of our show today focuses on the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. It's become a controversial issue whether or not the Department of Education has any value to the people of the United States and to the people of Iowa. I spoke with Steve King's office. They said they hadn't been briefed on this topic, so they could not release any information. But Trump is on the record as saying that he thinks much of the department could be eliminated. Ted Cruz, the leading Republican in Iowa, was on the record for its elimination.
I believe that the National Education Department helps us to have a cohesive plan for educating our kids. I believe that it's something that we need to support. We need to invest in our children, and I think that it's just ridiculous to look at getting rid of the Department of Education. My grandmother was a teacher. I was endorsed by the NEA. And when I went to interview with the ISEA, I was very saddened to find out that Steve King didn't even respond to their request for an interview. And so that, I thought that was pretty telling, that he couldn't show up for Iowa's children and families and their teachers. And a lot of Republicans like to just cut the budget, cut this, cut that. But in the long run, it doesn't help. I mean, you could cut down on your expenses with your car by not changing the oil, but your car is going to break down. So in the long run, not spending money is not an investment in our future.
What does the Department of Education do that you think is valuable?
I think a lot of the research that they do, as well as working on policy, the local school systems don't necessarily have that expertise to do the national studies that need to be done. So I think it's definitely something that we need to keep.
I'm talking with Kim Weaver. She is the Democratic candidate for 4th District in the U.S. House of Representatives, facing off against incumbent Steve King. Your last words for why you want the listeners' vote.
I truly am focused on solutions. One of the reasons why I actually decided to run was because I started to read about the different votes that my opponent took and realized how much, had he been successful, it would have hurt the people around us. I spent 20 years of my life advocating for people who didn't have a voice. And I believe the people of our district deserve a voice. And it's not just about being a Democrat. It's not about being a Republican or no party. It's about being an Iowan. It's about being a member of our communities. And it's about standing up for our neighbors and just working together to find solutions that help all of us instead of being divisive.
Thank you very much, Kim Weaver.
Thank you for having me.
This is Politics is Local on KHOI 89.1 FM. Thanks to Greta Anderson for that in-depth interview with Kim Weaver. The office of Ms. Weaver's opponent, the incumbent Steve King, was unable to follow through on an initial date for an interview in September, but is trying to arrange an October date. Education is an issue that seems to come up year after year in Iowa, especially when the legislature is in session. but it is not talked about very much during the campaign season. So KHOI decided to shine the spotlight on education for the remainder of our show today, to explore what people are talking about related to education and what some of our candidates are saying about it. We'll start at the federal level. In recent campaigns, as Greta mentioned, a number of presidential candidates have called for the dissolution of several federal departments, including the Department of Education. The Department of Education was started in 1980, and its mission is to ensure that students succeed academically and have access to a good education, with the idea that education will enhance the country's competitiveness. Whitney Wright, one of our Local Talk reporters, has looked into the role of the Federal Department of Education and how it is seen by various groups and politicians.
One thing at stake in the election is the future of public education. There's a wide disagreement between candidates on the value of public education. In fact, the continuation of the Department of Education is in question. It's worth noting that of all 15 executive candidates, it has the smallest staff and receives the third highest amount of funding following the Department of Defense and Department of Human and Health Services. They have programs that provide loans, grants, and work study to students in high education, student debt relief, minorities, and recently special education in public schools. The new education law, Every Student Succeeds Act, is a program designed to improve educational outcomes for all, close achievement gaps, increase equity, and improve the quality of instruction, which replaced No Child Left Behind Act from the Bush administration in 2001. They also had a huge involvement during the civil rights era with race and national origin discrimination laws, and more recently, disability discrimination laws. All that being said, a huge question circulating is the Department of Education fulfilling that goal? Do we keep or abolish it? Among Americans, there is a lot of disagreement and strong opinions on this issue as well. For instance, there's this grassroots group called U.S. Parents Involved in Education, composed of parents and educators, who launched a campaign earlier this year called Stop Fed Ed, which would like to abolish the Department of Education and return all control to the state and local level. They claim their quality of education is just not up to a par. And according to the DOE website, parents choosing to homeschool their children has gone up to 61.8% between 2003 to 2013.
So that's a radical change.
Yeah, huge increase.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that many are silently in agreement that Department of Education is failing its students and educators. January 27th of this year, U.S. Parents Involved in Education, a group of parents and educators looking to seize the Department of Education, launched a campaign that was actually in Des Moines at Holiday Inn and Conference Center. Therefore, there must be support of this movement here in Iowa. The campaign is called Stop Fed Ed, and the speakers were co-director Sherry Few, Karen Lamoureux of the Arkansas chapter, and Tamara Scott of the Iowa chapter. Lamoureux wrote a book on the issue titled No Choice, No Voice, Rotten to the Core, which focuses on the loss of parental rights to their child's education they feel are being monetized by the federal government. The speakers at the press conference claimed it is time to stop just spinning our wheels, since we are not gaining the achievement we are looking for, and that it is time to end the Department of Education and federal control of education. They claim to be weary of failed reforms after 40 years. This is a clip from their conference in Des Moines.
We have come to the conclusion that it's time for us to quit spinning our wheels in our states and not gaining the kind of achievements that we're looking for. And we've decided that it's time to put an end to the U.S. Department of Education and end all federal mandates on education. That's why today we're unveiling our campaign, Stop Fed Ed, and we're asking you to join the movement.
I'm Karen Lamoureux, a member of United States Parents in Education, as well as Arkansans for Education Freedom, and author of No Choice, No Voice, Something's Rotten to the Core. As stated earlier, we have grown weary of the constant rebranded reforms coming down from the Federal Department of Education and its allied bureaucrats at the state level. And now it is time to attack the problem head on and get it at its root. Our children are coming home emotionally damaged from these reforms. Our academic achievement continues to go down. Meanwhile, our federal spending continues to go up with no results. The United States Department of Education has had 40 years to get this right. Instead, they've shown nothing but pure incompetence and failure. Academic achievement is at an all-time low, and parents are feeling the fracture of their parent-child bond. I am pleased to stand on this stage with activists, with moms and dads, with folks who just got involved in their community to make a difference because they saw the damage taking place in their schools and to their own children. Our children belong to us, the parents. We're asking every candidate right now, candidates for president, to sign a pledge of how they're going to take care of doing away with the Department of Education. It's time for us to take education back, and we're going to call our candidates to be the first ones to do that. Please, again, go to our website, uspi.org, and join the movement. Thank you.
On the other hand, we have the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals that advocate high-quality education, released a statement expressing concern over Trump's plan for future education, stating that unregulated, unaccountable, for-profit charter schools have destabilized our public districts, defrauded our taxpayers, and left our kids and educators worse off, not better. And charter schools are one of the options if the Department of Education is terminated. Actually, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, spoke on behalf of Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton at the DNC back in July, raising public education as an election issue. Historically, teacher unions have always favored Democrats and the importance of public education access. The American Federation of Teachers is a union of professionals that are committed to ensuring all students have equal access to adequate education. Here we have a clip of her speaking at the DNC.
Just look at Trump University to see how he operates. Salespeople were told to exploit people's fears, and let me be very careful, I quote, a single parent that may need money for food into useless, high-cost seminars. Instead of an education, students lost thousands of dollars and got nothing in return. That's Trump in a nutshell. Manipulating people's fears to enrich himself. He is completely unqualified to be in the Oval Office. So thankfully, we have a different choice, and it's a great one. Hillary Clinton. Hillary's worked her entire life to level the playing field for working families. That starts with public education from pre-K to college. She has a plan for universal early childhood education. She'll reset education policy to focus on creativity and critical thinking, not on more testing. And she'll make public universities free for working families, a stark contrast from Trump's for-profit scam. Hillary is the most qualified candidate to run for president in my lifetime. She'll wake up thinking every day how to help us. That choice couldn't be clearer. We must elect Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine. Thank you very much.
Welcome back. That segment was brought to us by KHOI reporter Whitney Wright, and the last speaker you heard was from the American Federation of Teachers speaking at the Democratic National Convention. You're listening to Politics is Local on KHOI. We're talking about education, and right now we're talking specifically about the Department of Education. We also wanted to get the perspective of someone working within education who might see the federal department and its role differently. So KHOI reporter Susan Franzen interviewed Dr. Mandy Ross, the Associate Superintendent of Ames Community Schools.
We have a question about the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought the best way to find out what this meant locally was to find out what the Department of Education does here in Ames, mm-hmm. and what would go away if it were abolished?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Susan, because throughout my 30-some year career, the U.S. Department of Education has always been in place. So it would be kind of a revelation for those of us who've been in the field for a while to see what it would look like without it. But I, you know, pondered your question a little bit, and I think that one of the benefits would be less federal reporting with No Child Left Behind, which is now Every Student Succeeds Act. There's a lot of federal reporting required, and so it goes to the state. The states pass it on to the feds. And there are a lot of compliance issues that would likely drop out of place as a result of abolishing the United States Department of Education. One of the concerns I would have, however, would be the implications for some of the federal funding we get. And we get hundreds of thousands of dollars, not a significant part of our budget, and they're very controlled about how we can use those federal funds. But we get Title I funding for reading and math instruction for disadvantaged students, for example. We get Title II funds for professional development. And that's only one of our professional development pots of money that can be applied to support folks like administrators. Some of those would fall out. We get some assessment money from the federal government, which helps with the costs for our required testing. And we also get some English as second language funds from the federal government. So those title funds, as they're called, question I would have is, what happens with those? Do they totally go away? And how does that look? And so that would be a concern, because we've become dependent on those funds as the state has reduced the amount of spending we can do in our districts. And that's an aside to the federal question. You know, to have less accountability to the federal government that tries to make rules for everyone, make laws for everyone, so that what fits in Chicago or Houston or L.A. fits in Ames. That's not very practical, and that's one of the frustrations, is that it's kind of a one-size-fits-all model. And even with Race to the Top, when they were trying to be more flexible, there's still a lot of pieces that come together that everybody has to follow the same rules. And even in a high-performing district like Ames, it's very difficult sometimes to fall within those parameters, because our needs are considerably different than other larger districts, especially urban districts. You know, and one of the questions, too, that I think comes into play with that is the Common Core. And honestly, as a curriculum person for closing in on 20 years now, that's concerning to me, because I would tell you that this is one of the first times in my 30-some year career that I'm seeing some continuity in what kids are learning, whether it's district to district in Iowa or state to state. And that's really important, too, because in a very mobile society, we need to have some continuity. And since Common Core right now simply addresses literacy and math, and the science is addressed through a different set of curriculum, it's really important that students have that continuity when families move, so that they're not having to start all over or missing big gaps in their learning when families move, as they often do in this day and age.
Do you have any insight into why people are opposed to Common Core?
You know, I haven't had a lot of conversations with folks, but I think most of what I have learned is that it's misperceptions. I think anytime you try to have something that's where there's a level of continuity, that, you know, there's kind of a misunderstanding, and so I think people fill in gaps in their own understanding when the story is not clear to them. And with the Common Core, I think one of the greatest misunderstandings is that it did not come from the United States Department of Education. In fact, it was a grassroots process where it came from the states, and the states then gathered into a consortium where they then said, we're going to adopt this, or some of the states didn't adopt the Common Core. And then some of the states have dropped out because of the political pressure from constituents in their states. I personally am much more amenable to it simply because, as a person who used to reach out to different states, different school districts, and other organizations, other education organizations, to develop our local curriculum, that to me is too piecemeal. We did the very best we could. It was best practice at the time. But now our job is really to understand the Common Core and then provide our teachers with the professional development to really deliver that with fidelity in the classrooms. And that is a much more meaningful experience to me and to our teachers as we really work to meet the needs of students.
Are there any other comparable requirements, I guess you'd say?
Well, we do have state reporting requirements, but a lot of those are related to the federal reporting requirements. So I think that it would just loosen up and give some more of that local control back to districts instead of always worrying. I mean, right now, this past week, I've been working on my state reporting because that goes up to the federal government. And that takes a lot of time and effort in local school districts that really pull us away from teaching and learning and doing what's best in the district for kids.
Well, are there any things that you wanted to talk about that I haven't mentioned?
As I was thinking about our conversation today, Susan, I think that those were the key things that really fit in relative to the United States Department of Education. I think the only thing that is more a local issue is, or a state issue more accurately, is the fact that our state government puts a lot of restrictions on our public schools. And I think the caution there, anytime we're putting a lot of restrictions on schools, including how we spend our money, we've got a lot of professional development money that can't be used at the classroom level. In other words, I have professional development money I can use to help our teachers get better, but at the same time, if I'm constantly pulling teachers out of the classroom, the kids are the ones that suffer. So those pots of money are very siloed right now coming from the state, and I think that's a caution that we have to have. And I think many of our constituents aren't aware of the fact that we may be getting a good chunk of money from the state, but the state then puts a lot of parameters on how that money is used. And consequently, it doesn't mean we can use it for staffing. In other words, if we could put more teachers in our classrooms, that would be great. But with the funding restrictions that are provided by the state, that's not an option. So that very siloed approach to state funding is becoming problematic. It takes away that local control. And most of our constituents, I find in my conversations out in the community, are not aware of that fact. And that's a problem. If you talk to legislators, they'll tell you that, you know, a large part of the state budget is going to education. But what's not being said is, but we're telling schools exactly how they can use those pots of money because we've broken it and siloed it so much that it can only be used for certain purposes. And it starts unraveling the fabric of local control and what we can do in our districts to best meet the needs of our students as opposed to what's happening in Waterloo or Des Moines or Council Bluffs, for example. So I think that's the only other thing that crosses my mind is just the state impact on what's happening in the Ames Community School District and any other school district in the state, because that's where we're running into problems.
That was Susan Franzen speaking with Dr. Mandy Ross, the Associate Superintendent of Ames Community Schools. We're staying at the local level because this is the show, Politics is Local, which is a special series KHOI is bringing to you in the lead up to the elections in November. KHOI reporter Greta Anderson has been following education issues in Iowa for a number of years, particularly how education is addressed in the Iowa legislature each year. She prepared this summary of education issues in Iowa as she has reported on them over the years. On the local level, in the state of Iowa, funding for education has been the major issue. In the past couple of years, the Democrat-controlled Iowa Senate has pushed for a 6% increase in funding, or as a compromise, a 4% increase. But the Republican-controlled House has refused to budge from an increase of around 1%. Democrats say this does not keep up with increases in costs and necessitates that schools reduce staff. After the 2015 session, advocates of increased education spending were particularly upset when a hard-fought compromise between the two houses was vetoed by Republican Governor Branstad. Also at issue has been the timing of these votes. By law, the Iowa legislature, which begins meeting in January each year, is required to set the funding not for the school year beginning in the upcoming fall, but for the school year 1.5 years in the future. This time frame is intended to allow school leaders to plan ahead. In the past 2 years, however, the Republican-led House has yet to bring to debate the following year's increases, focusing only on the year immediately at hand. At KHOI, we're also interested in how this year's candidates position themselves on education. We'll start at the national level. Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson and Republican candidate Donald Trump say they would like to abolish the Department of Education, feeling that the federal government has no place in education and that all control should be left at the state and local levels. The phrase they use is pro-school choice, which advocates for systems like charter schools, vouchers, where you can choose the school you would like with a redeemable government certificate to pay tuition fees, magnet schools, and other approaches often called neoliberal approaches to education. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton says she would keep the Department of Education and utilize it to rebuild public schools and focus on improving teaching quality. The same can be said for Jill Stein from the Green Party, although the Green Party approach differs, since Stein would repeal No Child Left Behind and Every Student Achieves and end high-stakes testing because of their punitive effects. Turning to Iowa now, a phone call to Representative Steve King's office specifically asking about the Department of Education yielded the response that they hadn't been briefed and could not comment on that question. Kim Weaver, as you heard, is for maintaining the Department of Education and supports its role in expanding access to higher ed through Pell Grants and the like. We contacted the offices of Senator Chuck Grassley, but have not been able to obtain a response from them about education issues. Some positions on his website, such as championing tax initiatives for higher education, may indicate support of government involvement in education. Beth Wessel Crochel is a Democratic member of the Iowa House of Representatives, representing District 45, and is currently running for re-election. Her position on educational issues figures prominently on her website. She notes the constant delays and stagnant state investment in Iowa public schools. Republican candidate Sandra Child Smith, her opponent, supports making higher education affordable, but also supports school choice, which is generally associated with less governmental involvement. Other insights into education issues in Iowa can be gleaned from an audit of the Iowa Department of Education that was released this past Monday. The audit stated that the department ignored a law to collect reports from each public school, each area education agency, and community college to document equal employment opportunity programs and to report their efforts to prevent discriminatory employment practices. Quoting from the Des Moines Register, these rules are intended to help assure fairness and to avoid litigation that has recently cost taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars. So based on all of this, one can see where people's frustration comes from. Frustration with politicians and with both state and federal departments of education. Sometimes it seems like students and teachers are being held hostage by politicians and bureaucrats, and that we have lost the real meaning of education. But most people still believe in our public education system and believe we need to make it work better. KHOI reporter and ISU student Whitney Wright is very passionate about education, so we asked her to tell us about her educational experiences before she got to ISU.
How did you feel of the quality of public education you got?
Not too good, even though I got a much better end of the deal compared to the education I saw other students around me receiving. Overall, the education I got was lacking. With certain subjects, I pretty much had to educate myself.
How did you experience it as lacking?
Well, for instance, when it came to courses like history, you received limited information in topics like the Civil War. It was very biased. In fact, one of the teachers was a heavy Southern lifestyle enthusiast. So imagine talking about the Civil War from him.
What is a Southern lifestyle enthusiast? What is it?
Like,
that's like a Southern term.
Yeah, like we should have won the war.
Okay.
Yeah, that sort of deal. An example, like, rhetoric he used, like, he didn't call it the Civil War, but he called it the War of Northern Aggression. He made it a war question.
So on a test, you had to say that the Civil War was called the Northern War of Aggression?
And if you answered with Civil War, that was the wrong answer. And mind you, this was a class preparing you for college. I personally feel that no matter the level of one's courses, everyone deserves good, thorough, quality education. If I receive that treatment in an advanced placement course, imagine what students in regular remedial courses receive. I was a peer coach that helped students in less advanced classes, and I could clearly see they weren't getting any better because the teachers didn't engage with the students on any of the subjects they were supposed to be teaching. They were just given a bunch of busy work.
Saying that, how do you feel about the question, should the Department of Education be terminated or should it continue if your experience with public education wasn't that great?
I definitely say we should keep the Department of Education in place despite my experience with public education, because you can improve the proficiency of teachers and improve curricula. Given that I grew up in the South and the education I experienced, it seems like that if Texas and many other states were given complete control over education, they would tarnish subjects and neglect or even hinder students from getting the education they deserve. We have a better chance of ensuring that everyone isn't subject to that type of experience if we keep federal government oversight in place. It would certainly help students to prepare for college. Less students will feel unprepared for college and overwhelmed due to not having learned complete material beforehand. When that happens, and students fail out of college and into debts, it's just really cataclysmic.
This is Politics is Local, and we're talking about education today. That was Whitney Wright, KHOI reporter, speaking about her experiences in education before coming to Iowa. People might think that those kinds of disparities exist in Texas, but not in Iowa. But that assumption is not necessarily correct. There are significant racial disparities in measures such as graduation rates, enrollment in advanced or AP courses, and disciplinary referrals, among other things, right here in Iowa, and even in Ames. So when people vote in November, they might ask themselves, which candidates are committed to improving our education system, and how will they do it? Will they take up the call of education for the public good? Or does the candidate see education as just another item on a budget to be tinkered with and brokered away? We hope we have given you much food for thought today as you consider the candidates on the national, state, and local levels. This election season seems to be focused so much on media hype and non-substantive issues. At KHOI, we are committed to doing more than that. We recognize that politics is local, but that we also sit in a larger context that cannot be ignored. Thank you for tuning in and listening to this installment of KHOI's Politics is Local, a special series that looks at issues, candidates, and constituents in anticipation of Election Day on November 8th. Politics is Local will be airing until Election Day on Thursday morning at 7 a.m., and it will be rebroadcast on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. I'm Gail Seiler, and I've been your host for today. Our engineer was Evan Taylor. Thanks, Evan. And our theme music is Hometown Glory by Adele.
I've been walking in the same way as I